Good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Wednesday, February 28, 2007. We'll continue today with the governor's recommendation for the Department of Administration. And then, although we don't have the bill, as long as we're talking about the Department of Administration, we'll review at least some of the concepts of the proposed merger of the Department of Employee Relations. I won't take public testimony on that today, however, because, as I said, the bill has just gotten out of another committee and it's on its way to us. And at some point when we actually have the bill before us, then it's it'll be appropriate time. But I figured as long as we have the department here, we can at least get some background information on it. We will have to be out of here before 2:45 today because this room is going to be used at 2:45 for another meeting. So we'll have to, wherever we're at, we're just going to have to finish off there. So we'll continue on, Commissioner Badgerow. Welcome back. And we've got a few more things to wrap up today. So welcome back to the Budget Division.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. I know that I'll cede most of that time to Commissioner Anderson because we have this morning only to cover three remaining budget change items. Plus, we're going to present some information on the history of the budget of the Land Management Information Center around some questions that were raised last time. So we're going to cover those four things. With that, I will introduce Kent Allen.
Okay, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kent Allen. I am the Director of the Materials Management Division within the Department of Administration. I'm going to cover two of the budget initiatives that remain undiscussed. The first is a request for three temporary positions that would be charged with reducing the cost of state consulting contracts. Some of you may remember in the governor's State of the State address a few weeks ago, he singled out one state employee for special recognition, and that was Brenda Willard of our division for her work with relate to strategic procurement, including negotiation. And what we're trying to do with this proposal is to bring the targeted efforts that we have made on the goods and services side of our work to the consulting contract side as well. On the goods and services side, I think we have an extremely impressive track record. At the time we put together the budget proposal, we reported to you that we had $9.4 million in savings or cost avoidance that we had negotiated in state contracts since we began keeping track of this in FY06. That amount has actually gone up $2.4 million since we issued the budget document, so we're up to $11.8 million. It's gone up more than the cost of the annual general fund appropriation to our entire division. So I think the message I would hope you would get out of that is that investment in staff who can focus on contract negotiation is a good investment for government. On the consulting side, state agencies have their own authority to award and negotiate contracts, and so there really isn't any central entity that's paying attention or assisting with negotiation on these consulting contracts. And in FY06, the state awarded $364 million worth of consulting contracts. So that's a lot of money to spend if no one is paying close attention to whether we're really getting the best price, best value out of those consultants. As part of the work that we've done since Commissioner Badgerow has been in administration, we've put a heavier emphasis on cost of professional technical contracts in a couple of ways. Let me mention this real briefly. The statutes just say that cost has to be a consideration when you're evaluating responses to RFPs. But what we found when we looked at the details is that many agencies evaluated cost at 5 or 10% of the weight of the evaluation. Last year, or actually in August of 2005, we issued a policy that indicated that agencies would have to evaluate cost at 30 or 40% of the evaluation points in varying situations. And what we found is that vendors are certainly sharpening their pencils under that scenario. We did some analysis to determine what impact this policy would have on state contracts, and we looked at 104 consulting contracts that had been awarded before the policy went into place. and determined that 19 of those 104 would actually have been awarded to different vendors under this policy, and the state would have saved $2,593,000. So what we're hoping to do is expand on that cost focus by taking it yet another step and actually doing intensive negotiations with prospective vendors. We've started doing that, or encouraged agencies to do that on sort of an informal basis. And so far, they've reported 26 success stories and a savings or cost avoidance of $773,000. But we think that's the tip of the iceberg. Agencies actually awarded 1,652 consulting contracts in FY06 and did 973 amendments. So if we have 26 contracts that were negotiated, clearly there's a lot of opportunity there that we may be missing. But agencies need help with this for a couple of reasons. In some situations, they don't even understand that they have the legal authority to negotiate. Often they believe that if they evaluate responses to an RFP, award to the winning responder, they just have to accept that price as part of what they have evaluated and chosen as the first place responder. But beyond that, even if agencies know they have the authority to negotiate, they don't really have the skills in-house to do that. Most employees who work on consulting, who develop consulting contracts, do only a handful in their career, so it's not anything in which they have particular expertise. And there's no reason they should. I mean, their expertise is obviously in the program area that they're managing. And then some employees find it intimidating to negotiate, particularly if it's with a vendor with whom they've had a long-term relationship or need to look forward to a positive future relationship. So what we're finding as we get into this area is that a partnership between admin and the agency is really the way to go. The agency brings the technical expertise with respect to the subject matter and the contract content, and admin brings the negotiating expertise and potentially the willingness to really be the bad cop if you need a bad cop on the scene. Just one recent example of a success with this sort of partnership was on the contract for MAPS-related work assessing the possibility of a MAPS upgrade in the next several years. Admin partnered with the Office of Enterprise Technology and Finance and actually reduced the cost of a contract valued at roughly $500,000 by over $100,000. And some people were concerned that after we'd squeezed the vendor that hard, that it would negatively impact the relationship or that we'd be nickel and dimed on everything else through the rest of the contract work. The negotiator essentially walked away from that situation and left the contract management in the hands of the program people, who had an extremely good relationship with that contract vendor. Some other things that we would do with these resources, train agency staff in some areas that get the state into trouble. We occasionally find ourselves in court over consulting contract-related issues. So training on topics such as conflict of interest or appropriate evaluation methods we think would be useful. We also hope to consolidate some of the redundant contracts that are being developed at different agencies. We believe we can eliminate some duplicative efforts by looking at that from more of an enterprise perspective. To sum up, the mission of this group, if you chose to fund these positions, would be to reduce state expenditures on consulting contracts. We're asking for this as a one-time pilot investment. We're not asking for a base increase. We think we'll be successful, and if we are, we consider it our challenge to work with finance to create some sort of mechanism that would fund this activity ongoing out of the savings of the work rather than a general fund appropriation. So that's the concept. I'm happy to answer any questions that any of you would have.
So let me clarify the last point you made. You indicate you're spending about $364 million in these consulting contracts, and it's your belief that the money saved through these consultants will then generate enough money to fund this activity?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We think we will more than pay for the cost of this activity. But regardless, we are committed to not coming back and asking for more general fund dollars to do it in 2 years.
Have you saved enough money in some other ways that could be used to help fund this activity? We're looking at obviously trying to, you know, use some of the new money that's available to do this. Is there any other way that you've found money that through savings that we could use to do this?
Mr. Chair, the primary problem with that from an admin perspective is that the savings accrue to other state agencies and to local units of government.
Okay.
So there's no sort of there's no mechanism for my department to use that money to fund this activity.
Okay, you help somebody else save money. I get okay. Sir Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, I'm just wondering. Then, do you charge a percent? How will you set up your fee for them so that you can recover your costs and make sure you're paying for your own program?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, that's really the question we'll have to address. Assuming we get the money for this two-year pilot, that's the question we'll have to address at the end of the pilot because, as I said, we'll need to find a way to make this self-supporting through the work that we do. But we haven't developed that methodology, so I really don't have the proposal that would tell you how we'll do that. But you're absolutely right. That's what we'll need to do at the end of this pilot.
Mr. Chair, if I might as well, if I could interject. We talk about savings, but more often than not, in the case of these professional and technical contracts, we're really talking about cost avoidance, and I'll just give you the example listed on the slide. We wanted to engage a consultant to help us assess where we were on our procurement and accounting system, but we were working with a very limited budget within the Department of Finance budget. And in fact, these negotiations, the reduction that was achieved by the team, enabled the contract to be done within the Department of Finance budget. Otherwise, we would have been looking to assess agencies or find other sources of money to have paid for the original contract proposal. So it's really, I think, in this particular area, oftentimes, more oftentimes than not, a cost avoidance rather than a savings that can, in fact, be booked.
Okay. Other questions in this area? Okay, Mr. Allen. I'm sorry, Sir Roebling.
Oh, is he moving on to another?
Did you have another question, Sarah?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, I know you do a lot of the purchasing for different agencies, but that the legislature is not included in those purchases. And I just wanted to see if you had the capacity to take on the Senate, for example, if we did our purchasing through you.
Interesting question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling. I would certainly invite and encourage the Senate to use the statewide contracts that we develop, which are actually used. There's more money flowing through those contracts from state and local units of government and education than there is from state agencies. But state agencies are the only ones that are compelled to use our contracts based on the law. But any public entity is eligible to use them, and I would hope that the Senate would take advantage of that. In terms of doing one-time buys for the Senate, we're pretty strapped in terms of our resources, so I would hesitate to say, sure, send over your work. But we certainly would be happy to discuss whether there's any way to accommodate any of your special needs.
Does either the House of Representatives or judicial branch go through you?
Mr. Chair, if I might answer that, you know, if you build it, they will come, and we think we have a really good product in a number of these state contracts. And, in fact, we negotiated with the court system. We had to make a modest change in our terms and conditions to enable them to buy off of our state contracts, and now we've made that change, and they are, in fact, now utilizing the state contracts.
Okay. We'll have the legislature budget before us next week. Senator Wilson.
One of my concerns, especially in the technology field, is some of these contractors. I've heard stories of people coming for this, working with the state for 7 years, but they might live in a whole different, like, let's say, Florida. So they're making enough money to fly home every week, And somewhere in the state budget in that contract, there's enough fat in there, I guess would be the word, to say that there's money for somebody to fly, you know, how many trips is that over a seven-year period? So I'm concerned about those kinds of things. And I would like to reiterate, I think, why don't we do a lot of this stuff in-house? I would think for that kind of money, we could find somebody in Minnesota that could do that kind of work. In technology is just one example, I think.
Could some of this stuff be done in-house, these consultants and so forth?
Mr. Chair, Senator, as we've done some analysis, and I don't have the figures in front of me this morning, but we've done some analysis on what share of the consulting work is done in the state of Minnesota, and it's really quite high. There's also a statute that prohibits contracting with a professional technical contractor if there's a state employee who's able and available to do the work. So that's at least one sort of check and balance that's built into the system to avoid contracting for work that could potentially be done in-house.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, Wolstein, I don't know how far we want to take that type of logic, because we could get to the point of looking at how people drive home from a government job and say, oh, he drives a Cadillac, obviously we're paying him too much money. We could obviously find someone else who can drive a Chevy, and we want to hire him. At a certain point, you have to make a decision of letting the person's private lifestyle kind of be private. And as long as we get a good deal on the point of contracting, I think that's the point that we're trying to make, whether it's through a competitive bid or whether it's through a design build or whatever it is. Eventually, you have to – I know where you're going. You want to be responsible to the budget, but at the same time, it's a balance between being responsible to budget and then also just eventually you have to let go at looking at where they fly or where they come from. Granted, I think the point you're making is if there's a resource in Minnesota, we should keep it here. But quite often, sometimes with the high-tech jobs, that type of experience may not be available to the degree that we need in Minnesota for certain narrow contracts. So, but the only reason I'm bringing it up is sometimes we've had this discussion before over the years, and we usually kind of begin to caution ourselves, how far do we go?
And I appreciate that, but I'm struck that if we have a contractor with a vendor that's got enough money that vendor can give his employee an allowance to fly to Florida every week and back for a number of years, that's a lot of money in that contract that I would be surprised that I guess it kind of goes to why I really kind of like this idea of a central technology in the state, where why aren't we providing the engineering and building these computer systems within the state instead of paying all of this money to a vendor who's obviously making a profit beyond his employees' salaries and stuff. So that's more, I think, where I'm coming from.
Other questions on the contract negotiations? Okay. Mr. Allen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next initiative is for a targeted group disparity study. That sounds kind of jargony, but hopefully if you'll bear with me for a few minutes, you'll understand the issue and what I'm trying to explain. It's a request for $850,000 to do a statistically valid study that's needed by the state if we want to maintain Minnesota's affirmative action purchasing program. I'll give you a little bit of background. This program was created in 1990, and it gives certain procurement-related preferences to Minnesota small businesses. Selected businesses usually get a 6% preference if they qualify for this program. And as an example of that 6% preference, simple example, if the state's buying something, one vendor says, I'll sell it to you for $100. Another vendor who's eligible for this program says, I'll sell it to you for $102 or $103, or even as much as $106, that slightly higher-priced vendor would get the state's business. Eligibility in some cases is based on the location of the business. 42 counties are eligible on the basis of the economic status of those counties. In other cases, the business's eligibility is based on the characteristics of the person who owns and operates the business. So women, minorities, and individuals with substantial physical disabilities can be eligible as business owners. It's actually a bill that was passed off the floor of the Senate this year that would add veteran-owned small businesses to this program. The federal courts have dictated what a state must do before it's allowed to award preferences on the basis of race and gender. In some cases, such as veteran status or where a business is located, all the legislature really needs is a rational basis to say we want to give a preference to that business. But when you move into areas of race and gender, the courts apply a stricter standard. And that's been interpreted for purposes of government procurement to say that the state must show or prove a compelling interest if it's going to treat people differently on the basis of race or sex, and that we must, in fact, have statistical data of past discrimination before we can apply a preference as a remedy to that discrimination. So specifically, we would need an analysis to determine if purchases from minority and female-owned businesses are statistically proportionate to the market representation of those businesses. And what that analysis does is it ends up creating a fairly complex matrix of eligibility for businesses on the basis of the type of business, the value or the dollar amount of the state's business opportunity, and then the race and gender of business owners and the geographic region. So the last time the study was done, we ended up with 10 different categories of potential eligibility, and then groups such as African Americans, Asian Americans, and so forth are found eligible in some or all of those categories. Last time the study was done, African Americans ended up being eligible in 9 categories, which was the highest number. Caucasian females, 6 categories, and the other racial groups between 4 and 9 categories of eligibility. But this last study was done in May of 1999. It relied on data from fiscal year 96 and 97. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights in May of 06 put out an analysis of these sorts of programs and studies. And you won't be able to see this from here, but it says the report is called Disparity Studies as Evidence of Discrimination in Federal Contracting. And even though the title refers to federal contracting, 6 of the 31 recommendations in here are really focused on states and local units of government who run programs like this. And the first of those recommendations is the most important given the age of the data that we're currently relying on for our program. And the first recommendation is short. I'll read it to you. States and localities must discard disparity studies conducted using data that is more than 5 years old. The results are too outdated to justify preferential awards given today. Researchers must use current data. Well, Minnesota's data is over 10 years old, and it'll be over 12 years old by the time we complete another study. So you might be asking yourselves the obvious question, why did we wait this long in light of the fact that you should be using data that's much more timely? And the answer is it purely relates to the cost of this kind of work. It's extremely expensive to do this kind of a study. When we did one 10 years ago, we paid $500,000 for the consultants alone. We got an informal quote from that particular consulting group 3 years ago. They told us that it would cost at least $750,000 now. The state of Virginia did a study, looked at what various states and local units had spent, and concluded that costs of future studies like this would be in the range of $950,000. So when people hear this dollar amount, they tend to get a little bit of sticker shock. The reality is that to continue this program, we need a very complex, detailed, and time-intensive study done by experts in this area. The last time we did a study like this, it literally involved the analysis of over 593,000 state contracts. And if people have concerns about the cost and the complexity of this, this is a very good document to sort of remind anybody the rigorous tests that this kind of data has to survive in order to withstand court challenges. So far, the primary reason I've given you for why you would want to make this investment is that the federal courts tell us we have to if we want to continue the program. There's some other good reasons as well. One is that this program has historically been a very good incubator of small businesses in Minnesota. We mentioned two of those in our budget narrative. One is a company that started in this program and is now one of the top 10 Asian-owned businesses in the United States. Another is an African-American-owned company that's grown from 1 to 54 employees since it joined this program. And obviously, I'm not trying to say that this program deserves credit for the success of these businesses. It's the business savvy and initiative of the owners, obviously. But at a time when these were fledgling businesses, this program did give them a little extra opportunity in the state of Minnesota that they wouldn't have had otherwise. The other very good reason to support this admittedly costly initiative is the fact that the PCA and other Minnesota agencies are depending on this study as a continuing condition of receiving some of their federal grant money. PCA has estimated that they have $134 million at risk in this biennium unless they can demonstrate to the federal government that they are engaged in this type of analysis with respect to affirmative action in procurement. These federal rules are not my area of expertise, but I know we do have Lyle Mueller here from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency if you have further questions with respect to that. So that is why we're here asking for money of this magnitude. We really are at a point in time when we either need to do another study or shut down the parts of the program that give preference on the basis of race and gender. Any questions?
Yeah. So, what do they study the contracts to find out if we've actually let out the contracts to women or minority or disabled groups? And is that basically what the 850?
They look at the percentage of contracts awarded to minority and female-owned businesses and compare that to the number of such businesses that are viewed as. What's the phrase, Dorothy? Ready and available, able and available?
Ready.
Willing and able? Number of businesses willing and able to provide that sort of service to the state.
You mentioned PCA stands to risk $134 million in federal funds. Are there other agencies that are at risk or have been notified that they have to have updated data?
Actually, we should maybe let Mr. Chair, let Mr. Mueller address this, but my understanding is that some of the money that's included in that $134 million is grant money that PCA passes along to other Minnesota entities.
Maybe if Mr. Mueller can give us a better idea of what the consequences are of not updating information. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lyle Mueller. I'm the finance manager with the Pollution Control Agency. And as Mr. Allen stated, and as written up in the budget change item narrative, the narrative cites $134 million. That actually is our estimate of federal funds spread across the four state agencies that were cited in the change item. And those agencies are, the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, and PFA. For MPCA alone, our estimate is closer to $43 million that we apply for have estimated to apply for in the coming biennium.
Is there a way that this is being, we must have some mechanism that this is being tracked now, because presumably if a preference is given in a contract, somebody has to write it down. So we must be doing some data collection right now. Or is this just auditing what we're doing to make sure we're doing it the right way?
What are we doing that has to be studied, and how is that the study going to affect what we're doing?
Mr. Chair, we have data on which of our businesses are, in fact, eligible targeted businesses. That, unfortunately, isn't, and the amount, we could determine how much are going to our currently certified businesses. Again, if you go through this sort of material, you get a sense of the complexity of what the U.S. Civil Rights Commission says you need to really do this and have your data able to sustain a challenge in court. I can maybe pick a few things quickly out of here that would sort of point to the complexity. Utilization and availability measures and their numerators and denominators must represent the same time period to avoid any distortion from changes in the composition of the business community. Must draw comparisons between minority and majority-owned firms. They should exclude large publicly traded stock corporations. Test for the sensitivity of results to variations in methods and data. Effects of different groupings of industry and the presence of outliers that inordinately affect results. Conduct separate analyses for prime and subcontractor data. Compile disparity ratios comparing only prime awards for each group to the total prime awards. I mean, I could go on and on. It's really a litany of requirements as viewed by the Civil Rights Commission on how social scientists need to conduct this study in order for it to pass the strict scrutiny tests of the federal courts.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Wibling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, has there ever been a study done to determine how much additional money it costs the state to participate in it when we give preference? If we're paying higher costs for services and goods, have we ever determined what that cost is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, we haven't over time. We did a short-term analysis of that probably 5 or 6 years ago when the issue was raised. And over a very short period of time, we actually were surprised at how little additional cost there was to the state. It wouldn't be right to assume that we pay 6% more every time we award to one of these businesses, because one of the things we noticed when we did that short-term analysis is that often the winning bidder had proposed 0.5% more or 2% more. So the difference between the low bid and the preference bid was often fairly small. We also cap the amount of additional cost at
$50,000. Dorothy?
The most we would ever pay as additional cost in order to award to a small business is $30,000, and that came out of the analysis in the last disparity. So it was determined that that was an appropriate cap in this last time we did a disparity study.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to understand this for sure. So we don't think this costs us a lot of money, but it could, if we don't participate in a program like this, it could cost us grant money from the federal government. Is that what you're
yes.
implying? That they won't be forwarding grants to us potentially if we aren't participating in a program like this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, that's correct. And also keep in mind that the Senate is currently adding groups to this list. So if there was concern about the additional cost of the preference, we're significantly expanding the number of potentially eligible businesses this year with the adding the veterans to the group.
Any other questions? Senator Wolfson.
Mr. Chair, we're looking at I think we were looking at starting, what's the organization? Office of Grants Management. This seems, of course, this is contracts, but it seems like a very similar kind of purpose, you know, overseeing state grants and how they're awarded and received. It almost seems to me like it would be a nice pairing to have something like this be a part of a group like that, where maybe it could be an ongoing part of the office is examining contracts from the state on an ongoing basis. So I guess I would throw that out there as an option rather than contracting for $850,000 to have a study done that is very similar. We're almost duplicating that on the grant side. I just like maybe an opinion on that.
Well, of course, the grant, we've got to solve those, the mess with the grants I've got. But Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, one of the reasons this work is so expensive and we're estimating $850,000 is because there's a very small pool of, again, we're talking consultants who are social scientists who have the data and analysis skills to specialize in this type of work. So we are relying on some fairly unique expertise, and it's not something that you would routinely expect to have in a grants oversight group. It's really, the study isn't providing any sort of traditional oversight on the purchasing process other than to determine if there's a legal basis to give a slight preference to the businesses that are owned and operated by women and minority business owners.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Is there any way, just following up on that, I kind of think we probably will have to just hire someone, get it done. But once we have it done, would there be a way to keep it updated so we wouldn't have to come back in 5 or 6, 7, 8 years to do it again, so that there'd be kind of a running log of the information, and that would keep us eligible?
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, one would hope so. I would hesitate to say I know we can do that, but it would not be prudent of us to not make some efforts as we go through this initiative to find ways to maximize the value of this study and institutionalize something so that future requests would at least be more modest than this one.
Other questions? Oh, sir, we'll see.
Unfortunately, I do. And I'm concerned, maybe you can walk me through this process a little better, but you were talking about social scientists and high-level skills to conduct this survey, but aren't a lot of the forms that somebody fills out to have a contract with the state, doesn't there a request if they're a minority contractor? And wouldn't it really be more of a data collection than actual, you know, in figuring out percentages of state contractors or minority group than actually the work of a social scientist?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's a good question. I think the toughest part, and again, I couldn't do this study myself if my life depended on it, so I'm you know, a non-academic statistician person here trying to say something relevant in response to your question, but my sense is that the most complex aspect of it is that the analysts really need to study the entire business community. It's relatively easy to figure out who the state's done business with and the whether those are in fact minority or female-owned businesses. But they need to contrast that pool of businesses with all of the businesses in the local economy. And determine whether there's a disproportionate representation based on, in many different categories, you know, different categories of race, the male-female gender, rural, metro, different types of businesses and size of purchases within those businesses. I suspect the toughest part is the analysis of who is able and willing in the economy that the state hasn't interacted with, because they really need to find all of those businesses and do the comparison.
Other questions in this area? Okay, what's next?
I think we've got...
Mr. Chair, is it hot in here, or am I just having hot flashes?
I can't speak for you. I'm fine.
We're cool on this side.
Welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank
Please
you very
identify
much.
Yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Sheila Rieger. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Administration. Okay. Our Commissioner had to step out for another obligation.
Sure.
We have just two pieces left. The next piece is the compensation adjustment, and Lenora Madigan will go over that briefly.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Lenora Madigan, Director of Financial Management with the Department of Administration. I'll be addressing admin's compensation adjustment today. We're requesting $525,000 for the biennium. Last summer, when agencies were preparing biennial budget documents, finance directed agencies to include a 3.25% increase for salaries per year. And we later learned that the governor was going to be recommending a 2% increase. At that point, we reviewed our budget guidelines that the Commissioner Badgerow presented on Monday, and we decided that the recommended funds, the 2%, should be dedicated to areas of the department that support statutory responsibilities. We directed the available or the majority of those funds to two admin divisions that provide important core services to the state agencies. The two divisions that are receiving over 80% of the funds are the State Architect's Office and Real Estate Management. The decision to assign the funds in this manner allows us to continue to provide real estate and construction project management services to state agencies. So that will be how we have dedicated in the budget documents and how it's presented in them. Do you have any questions?
Just to double check, is the governor recommending 2% pay raises, first of all, for all employees? Is that that's the base?
This isn't a 2% pay raise. This is 2% in salaries and compensation, which will cover all the benefits, all of the cost of payroll that are associated with.
Okay. And members, this is probably one part of our budget area which is not we can't do all by ourselves, because it's going to look a little odd if one budget division comes out and says, let's give the 2% to the employees within our area, and some other one says, well, let's go 3% or 4%, and some other budget area says, no, we're not going to do any. So this is going to require close coordination with all the budget divisions, because, you know, state employees ought to be treated fairly across the board, or at least, you know, equally, so that it doesn't matter which budget division is looking at it. So I think this is one area that there is going to have to be some discussions at the Finance Committee level. Senator Olsen.
Thank you. One of the things I think we've heard as a reoccurring theme across this table is that finance, revenue, the Attorney General's office, CPAs, and auditors are in high demand in other industries, and that our salaries are not keeping up and not able to keep these people within the state. So I would suspect that there should be some compensation adjustment in those fields also.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Senator, I think there are a lot of people, particularly in this room right now, that would agree with that. That might be a question better addressed to the Department of Employee Relations or who work on compensation adjustments.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator, Senator Robley.
Thank you. I'm trying to figure out what you just told us, though, that you're going to take your 2% and only directed to some divisions of your agency, which means that some don't get any.
Madigan?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct. We really have a number of admin divisions who have very significant shortfalls within their budget as a result of over the years, the reductions that have taken place since 2002. And I think Commissioner Badgerow showed a slide of that earlier this week. And admin is funded in a variety of ways, as she talked about as well. Some are internal service funds. These funds are only for general fund divisions that the governor is recommending. And we are assigning them to the two divisions that had the greatest need to meet existing salary obligations.
And keep in mind, there will be labor negotiations too, and at some point, you know, some of this it may have to come out of the base if that's what's negotiated. So, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because even if salaries are flat in some areas, there's always the benefits issue, which probably isn't flat. And I haven't really heard what percent of increase that would take, even out of the 2%. Have you estimated that?
I'm not sure.
Maybe Dewar will be able to tell us. So at least
1%. The commissioner, I think about half.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Next, we'll ask Mr. Arbeit to come up to the table. We'll talk a little bit about LIMIC, which you've heard briefly about, the Land Management Information Center change item.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is David Arbeit. I direct the Office of Geographic and Demographic Analysis and also the Land Management Information Center, which I've directed since 1994. What you see on this slide is basically contained in your budget document on pages 45, 6, and 7. And I want to revisit this because there was some confusion on Monday about some of the numbers on this slide. What we do at LIMIC is provide coordination services for the use of GIS technology. In the current biennium, our budget is about $3.4 million, and we've done a number of good things, which I can talk about if you like. But an important point here is that data that we provide and are also provided through a web portal that relates to our clearinghouse function are used by agencies all over the state, other state agencies and local governments, to the extent that we're now providing about 90,000 data downloads to state agencies and local government. And that's data that they don't have to develop, they don't have to invest in, they don't have to maintain separately from this central location. Now, we have the budget proposal does reduce our general fund, our total appropriation to $1.8 million. Now, most of that, in fact, all of that is in the general fund portion of it because we are funded both through a general fund appropriation and as well as through a enterprise fund that is totally self-supporting, and I'll explain that in a minute. That second piece is not directly affected by this reduction. Now, what we do are many things that you may or may not be familiar with, and I'm not going to go over them in detail, but there are some things that I think merit attention. What you see here is one of 3,500 of the original public land survey maps from Minnesota, which were collected 150 years ago, and actually are used as a basis for all land ownership records in the state. Until 3 years ago, there was only one copy of these 150-year maps that was maintained in the Secretary of State's office. They were directly accessed, handled by surveyors who had to travel to the Capitol from all over the state in order to have access to them. We've now scanned those and made those available online, so they no longer have to do that. There are 30,000 downloads of that last year alone. Many of you may have seen either through commercial applications like Google Earth or MapQuest or through some application web services that come from the Legislative GIS Office or other agencies, examples of maps that have images in the background. Well, LIMIC is the organization that coordinated the acquisition of this data on behalf of Minnesota, leveraging about $500,000 in federal funds to match with a third, half of that amount in state funds to acquire that and then make that available throughout the state. And it's used all over the state right now. We also are the first organization anywhere in the country to develop a comprehensive land use database for the state. Now, this is aged, and we haven't been able to update it since the early 90s, but it is the only place where you can get a sense as to what uses of the land development results in around the state. And we also provide services that relate to what you heard from Tom Gillespie on Monday, providing the capability to map that census data so that we can keep track and visualizing where changes in population and where needs for services actually appear. We really focus our attention on four kinds of services. And first two relate to coordination and what we call clearinghouse. And those sets of services are entirely funded by the general fund appropriation. They are what we think of as fundamental services that other agencies depend on. Technology cannot be implemented in other agencies like the DNR or health or agriculture or education or deed, which are now beginning to implement the technology, without having these services and these kinds of services in place. And therefore, they are, in our view, justifiably supported by an appropriation. The second two, last two, are decision support tools, and our GIS consulting program are not entirely funded by the general fund. The decision support tools include something called DataNet that some of you may be familiar with. A state demographer makes extensive use of that to inform the public, as well as some software that we provide to schools around the state at no cost. And that is partly funded by the general fund, but these days it's mostly funded through contracts and grants. And the GIS consulting activity is entirely self-supporting. Our clients are mostly state agencies. Year to year it varies, but it varies between 70% and 80% of our total business is state agencies. They include some of the big state agencies that have GIS capabilities on their own, especially DOT and DNR and PCA, but they come to us for specialized support and services that they can't implement on their own. But more importantly than that, we also work with agencies that do not have the capability under contract to provide them with the ability to analyze their service needs, evaluate how effective they are, and to provide mapping services to the public. And a good example might be the Department of Education, which contracted with us to map the locations of all the school district boundaries and schools in Minnesota. Other than that, they had no way of mapping them and knowing where they are. We're currently working with the Department of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management to deploy GIS in the Emergency Operations Center. They don't have that capability. They don't have staff. They don't have the technology. They're working with us to provide that to them. And that's an example of what we do. We do about 30 to 40 projects a year. The staff that's supported through that activity ranges from 5 to 7 or 8, depending on how much work we do. We generate about $650,000 worth of revenue. Now, I want to get back to the data download issue. At LIMIC and through our clearinghouse functions, we are now downloading about 40,000 data sets a year to organizations around the state. So when you see GIS, other agencies coming to you and demonstrating their GIS applications to support anything from permitting to analysis of services, their ability to do that depends on their ability to get this data, which provides the backdrop for those kinds of mapping applications. In 1994, when I came here, LIMIC was the only organization in the state that had GIS capabilities, except for the DNR at the time. We were the data center for the state, but the truth be told, we only were able to deliver, partly because of demand, we only delivered about 30 data sets for the entire year at great expense. Now we're up to 40,000 that come directly from the Minnesota, the LIMIC site. In addition to that, the clearinghouse provides data through a portal that provides access for the public to other agencies' data stores. And that number was 90,000 in 2006. Now, that's a significant amount of data that's out there, and what it represents is really a cost savings or cost avoidance for agencies that don't have to acquire that data on their own. Now, I want to point out a new family of services that we're introducing, including things that we really have to do with web mapping, and it's not just data downloads, but we're directly providing now more than 50 services to other agencies that appear directly in their applications. So when you go to an agriculture website or when the agriculture staff manages this permit application program with GIS tool to identify where those permits are, much of that data is getting fed directly from a single source that we maintain at LIMIC. I think on Monday there were some questions about centralizing IT services. Well, this is a centralized IT service that's being used increasingly by other agencies as an alternative to developing their own capability. What you see here is something called North Star Mapper. It is not just a mapping tool, but it also is a portal for data downloads, and this is one of the 50 services that we talked about.
For the members' interest, Senate District 51 happens to be my district. And
oh, just a happy coincidence, I'm sure. So to get to the current budget, the current budget that we're that's before you is a budget that was approved in 2005 by the legislature, and the governor has not made any changes to that budget. And what that does is retain a provision that was passed in 2005 that established the base budget at $258,000, which is was actually a 75% reduction from what it had been the previous biennium. But we, thanks to the legislature, at least that was partly addressed, and we've been able to continue to function through this biennium, I think, pretty effectively. But at that lower base, we would basically have to reduce our staff to about 1.5 FTEs funded by the general fund. And what that'll do is reduce our ability to provide a whole lot of services, although we will do the best that we can. Now, what does that actually look like? And just graphically, this is what it would look like. And really all we're talking about is that portion of the budget. In yellow, you see the 06-07 appropriation. But we also have support our activities through a revolving fund and through federal grants, which comprised that total amount that was on that initial page. And the same is true with the FTE complement. We do have currently in 08 and 09 with the proposed budget about 8.8 FTEs, but only 1.5 of those will be funded by the general fund. Now, we haven't gotten to this place all in one step. In fact, LIMIC's budget has been in decline since 2000-2001. And compared with 2001, that budget has been reduced by 47% to this current biennium. What the governor's proposal will do will reduce it even further. So that's sort of the long-term picture. Where that would put us is here. Going forward, we would, with this appropriation, be able to allocate about half an FTE coordination, about one FTE to the data clearinghouse, and, of course, the rest of it would be supported by grants and contracts with the consulting services program. But that's pretty much it unless we really strike a gold mine with some federal grants, which occasionally we do. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Arbeit. We did have a bit of a discussion the other day on it, and, of course, these are the governor's recommendations. I think many of us have gotten contacts from some of your customers urging us to do more in this area, but we'll have that discussion. Is there further questions about the proposal and specifically how it's affecting this office? Sarah, we'll see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I read this, you're kind of picking up the slack with entrepreneurial type of, so you're okay with this, or I'm going to put you on the spot and ask what your thoughts are about this budget.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olstein, we've been very successful being entrepreneurial in terms of responding to the challenges since 2001. We can continue to function I guess at the current level of service, more or less, with some entrepreneurial activity, at the budget level that we have this biennium. Now, I can't honestly say that with the recommendation we'd be able to come anywhere close to filling the gap with further entrepreneurial work. We do the best we can. And moreover, I think it's fair to say that the ability of the consulting services program to function at its current approved rates, which are set to recover the costs, will be hampered somewhat because the consulting services unit will have to pick up a greater share of the infrastructure, the computer systems, the support of those computer systems that it now shares with the rest of the division.
Anything else, Jolzi?
I was listening, but I wasn't sure if I heard the answer in there. I think what I heard you say is that next biennium being cut down to 250-some thousand, it could be hard for you to make those numbers work.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'd say that I think we did a bit of magic in the current biennium, and it would take additional magic in the next biennium with those numbers. Yeah.
Okay. One last comment, if I may. And, you know, I've gotten more letters on this than transportation, education. So the people that use your services obviously value them. So just wanted to let you know that. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I appreciate hearing that. I know some of them, but not all of it.
Other questions on LIMIC? The commissioner has gone. Did admin have anything further they want to present to us?
Mr. Chair, this would conclude our presentation.
I do have one thing that it did come to mind the other day when we talked about the public information policy group, where they charge other agencies for their assistance. How much of that goes on, say, within Department of Administration, where you provide services to other agencies and then charge back the work that you provide to them? Is this just an isolated area, or is this something that goes on quite a bit?
Mr. Chair, members, we have a number of businesses within the Department of Administration that do charge back. Okay. Are you interested in more information, particularly about?
If you've got something you could provide to our office, I'd appreciate knowing a little bit more about that. I want to figure out where some of the dollars are going, how much the agencies are paying, and just where it's going. We'd like to see something there.
Absolutely. We'll get that to the committee. Okay.
Thank you. Is there anything else for the Department of Administration? We are going to look at the Department of Administration as well as the proposed merger with Dewar in just a minute if there are no other questions. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, the Senator Rest has a bill that would follow through with the governor's recommendation that the Department of Employee Relations be abolished and its duties transferred, many of them to the Department of Administration, but there's also going to be some other transfers as well, too. That bill is not yet in the Finance Committee, so it's not quite before this budget division yet.
Got reported today.
But I figured that as long as we had the Department of Administration here, we could at least get some background information on that, and then we'll schedule the bill at some point, probably next week or so, next Wednesday, I believe, at which point, if there's any public testimony, come before our division. So we will not take public testimony today, but I think for some background purposes, we can at least hear what the proposal is. So we do have Commissioner Anderson before us. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No. The bill is not here yet. You'll have an opportunity to present it here, but obviously you're the chief author of the bill, and this is just information for the Budget Division on this issue, so we don't have to spend a lot of time. Next week we'll have the bill before us. So. Commissioner Anderson.
Thank you. It's my understanding that the bill will be here shortly in time for next Wednesday.
It was reported today on the Senate floor, and it'll be sent to the Finance Committee tomorrow.
Today
it was, but since we didn't have the bill yet and we couldn't put it on the agenda, I didn't want to have it before us and have some debate discussion on something we didn't have time to give public notice on. So that's why I figured we'll have some background on it. But we will schedule the bill, I believe, next Wednesday at which time there will be public notice, and they can, you know, we can do vote on the bill, do whatever is proper at that time. But there are no votes today or public testimony today.
Okay, thank you. We have until 25 to?
There's going to be another meeting in this room at 2:45, so it takes a few minutes for us to clear on out and the next group to get in here. So by about somewhere after about 2:30 or so, we should be wrapping it up here.
Okay, Senators, I will I will go as quick as I can and stay on schedule here. So we have a PowerPoint presentation that there's also copies of those in your packet, and I'll go through each slide as quickly as I can. Excuse me. Again, I'm Commissioner Pat Anderson. I want to thank you for the opportunity to give you an overview of the functions and the budget of DOER, and also I will explain the proposed merger. The Department of Employee Relations is the state's human resource agency. It sets the state's human resource policy by protecting and upholding the merit system, which ensures competent staff are hired and equitably compensated. We negotiate state employee labor contracts. We write compensation plans and approve the pay plans for constitutional officers. With the exception of the Minsky faculty contract, DOER is responsible for all the state employee contracts in the executive branch. It also provides insurance and workers' compensation benefits for employees in all three branches of state government and certain quasi-state agencies. Now, in order to accomplish our agency's mission, the governor is recommending a general fund budget appropriation of $12.6 million, an open general fund appropriation of $1.3 million, which pays for the legislative required Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association, or WICRA. You've probably heard the term WICRA. In addition, it collects fees from state agencies and employees of approximately $1.44 billion. These dollars pay claims, premiums, and admin costs for state employee insurance benefits. So that adds up to a total of $1.457 billion in spending. So as you can see, only about 1% of DOER's budget is from the general fund. The other 99% is composed of revenues and expenditures in the various state employee benefit programs that we operate. We're a small agency, but we have a big budget. As I go through this presentation, I'll discuss the legislation that will be before you next week that abolishes DOER and merges its functions into the other agencies. But in brief, the plan calls for the Workers' Compensation Program to go to the Department of Administration. Center for Healthcare Purchasing Improvement is slated for the Department of Health, and the remaining DOER functions are proposed to merge into finance. Now, during the recent budget cuts, DOER was cut from just over 200 FTEs to about 143 FTEs currently. We're a very lean department, and we've already eliminated unnecessary functions. I want to tell you a little bit about what we've accomplished over the past biennium. The State Employees Group Insurance Health Plan, which we all call Advantage, continues to perform well. It's a program that provides health insurance benefits for state employees in all three branches of government. We're very proud of how we've managed the program. In 2006, we had a 0% increase, and we returned $19.9 million in premium dollars through a premium holiday. And this year, in 2007, we had a 9.9% increase, which was actually about average. Some of you have inquired about the relation between the December 06 premium holiday and the January 07 premium increase. And on the face of it, having an almost 10% increase right after a premium holiday might seem a little odd, but there's good reason for this. First, the dollars we returned were collected in 2005, and we believe those were generated by a one-time dip in claims. And even though we held the 2006 premium increase to zero, our health care trends still increase. And we believe they'll continue to do so in 2007 and 2008. So if we hadn't increased the premium in 2007, we'd be looking at a very large increase in 2008 and beyond. Now, we contracted with Minute Clinic, an opening office in the Centennial Office Building. The purpose of opening that clinic was to help employees make wiser healthcare choices and to save money. Every time a member seeks care at a convenience clinic, our plan saves $50. Not only do they save money, but they also save members money. Co-pays are only $10, and all the first dollar deductibles are waived if you go to a convenience care clinic.
I didn't know they had one.
We had enough success with those that in 2006, we expanded the market for Advantage members, all of us, by adding Target, Now Care Express, and Health Systems to our network. We've also made two significant technology changes this biennium. Semaphore, which is the state's payroll, HR, and benefits information system, has migrated from a mainframe to a Windows Server platform. This change will retain compatibility with the vendor, which allows Semaphore to be better positioned to receive upgrades and support, as well as to reduce costs. That change is complete and it went smoothly. We also launched onboarding, which is an electronic tool used to bring new employees into state service more efficiently. It collects data from new hires and then forwards that information to agency staff so they can set up our office space, desktop computers, and so on before the employee actually starts work. Finally, the data that was collected is automatically moved into the Semaphore system, which eliminates the input of redundant or duplicative data. With that, I want to further explain how the department works. Now, for budget purposes, the agency is divided into two areas, human resources and employee insurance. Human Resource Management, or HR, provides the executive branch with centralized personnel services. It also includes the Center for Healthcare Purchasing Improvement, and it provides DOERS administrative functions, including administrative, fiscal services, and the commissioner's office. This program, the HR program, has 5 budget activities and 63.8 FTEs. Now, all of these activities but the center are proposed to be merged with finance. The center is slated to go to health, where they already have been working closely with staff. This program is recommended to have a $12.6 million general fund appropriation and special revenue funds in the amount of $2.6 million. Both of our two change items are in this program. In brief, the first is a request for $1 million in increased funding for the Center for Healthcare Purchasing, and the second is a compensation adjustment. This is $281,000 in general fund dollars, and as you know, that's the governor's recommendation of 2%. And I would like to answer a question you had earlier. Contracts are settled across the board. As you know, everyone gets the same percentage increase. I think what admin was looking at is taking those dollars and just shifting them into another program fund, but they still have to pay their employees according to contracts, according to what's settled. So I think it was just an accounting shift. So. Now, I want to move on to, I'll explain those in more in detail later. I want to move on to the activities in this program. The first activity is HR, technology, and analytics. This unit identifies, develops, and enhances technologies that help make the state's HR system more efficient and effective. These are the same people that came up with the idea of onboarding and implemented it. This unit also maintains and analyzes data, and this is the raw data that provides the information labor relations needs for bargaining and is used by state agencies to analyze staffing needs. This activity is proposed to move to the Department of Finance because it works closely with the other parts of HR to help develop technology and maintain the raw data necessary to provide the overall human resource activities and guidance for state agencies. This budget's activity is recommended from a general fund appropriation is $1.25 million for the biennium. The special revenue funds are fees collected from state agencies and are used to operate ResMix. Now, that's a statewide system where agencies post all their open positions and the processes resumes for state job applicants. The next section, Agency and Applicant Services, is the unit that administers ResMix. In addition, they set personnel policies and procedures regarding recruiting, selection, and classification. Finally, this unit is responsible for reviewing and monitoring affirmative action plans, ADA programs, and it provides equal opportunity reporting. This activity provides the remaining human resource activities that help ensure the merit system is upheld. The merit system ensures fair and open competition for state jobs and that our employees are fairly compensated. These activities are proposed to merge with finance. The core functions of the human resource system, which are classification, compensation, labor relations, and selection, are very tightly integrated, and they're brought together to provide integrated HR solutions. And we believe that it's imperative that these core functions be kept together. This activity has 20.3 FTEs and a general fund appropriation of $3 million. Now, Labor Relations and Compensation negotiates and administers 8 labor agreements and 2 pay plans. And these same 11 staff members also provide training and arbitration services for state agency. They develop compensation information used for negotiations and to ensure that state employees are being paid in accordance with law and labor agreements. This unit also administers a compliance process for the Local Government Pay Equity Act, ensuring that all political subdivisions eliminate gender-based wage inequities. We're also responsible for reviewing and making decisions on local government requests to exceed the salary cap, which are much less than they used to be in the past with the changes we made. Under the merger plan, they're proposed to join the Department of Finance. The proposal will retain this unit's direct report to a commissioner, and it'll continue to be headed by a deputy commissioner. This is a measure that the unions insisted upon, and I agreed with them. Now, Labor Relations receives a biennial general fund appropriation of $1.9 million. Additionally, it has $650,000 in miscellaneous special revenue funds, which are mostly dollars paid to the unit by other agencies for investigative services. Labor Relations carries the contract for these personnel investigations, and so these are pass-through dollars. It also includes about $6,000 in labor relations and pay equity training costs. These are training programs put on by this unit for which other state and local entities pay a nominal fee to attend. The administration activity includes all the internal costs of operating the agency as well as 2 programs. It includes the fiscal, human resource, information management, and the commissioner's office. Agency staff funded through this appropriation also support combined charities and the vacation donation program. The merging of human resource data and management with current finance responsibilities will help ensure a more efficient use of state resources and accountability in agencies. The general fund appropriation for this administration activity is just over $5 million. Special revenue funds on this line are primarily DOER dollars paid in from other units within DOER to pay for their internal technical support. This includes our desktop computers, software, phones, and so forth. About $30,000 of these dollars are associated with the State Employees Combined Charity Program. They're funds that state employees raise through fundraisers that pass through DOER and are given to charity. About $13,000 are funds paid to DOER by other agencies who support a DOER-developed fiscal reporting system known as FIS. And this is a system we're really proud of. It provides managers across governments secure and easy-to-use fiscal reports that include a broad range of criteria. It's a database application that retrieves financial and HR information from the state's information warehouse containing maps and semaphore data, and it operates on the web. And it was developed to provide information that was necessary to ensure that day-to-day operations are maintained within budget. There are currently 4 agencies that are using it, DOER and 3 others, Finance, Health, and the Faribault Academies. And the Center for Healthcare Purchasing Improvement is a new program that was initiated by Senator Cascaden and approved by the 2006 legislature. The center was enacted to support the state in its efforts to be a more prudent and efficient purchaser of quality healthcare services. To accomplish the mission, the center assists state agencies in developing and using common strategies for healthcare performance measurement and purchasing. This coordinated approach is intended to promote greater transparency of healthcare costs and quality and greater accountability for healthcare results and improvement. Now, the governor's budget recommends a $1.3 million budget for the biennium. $1 million of this is a change item, since this was just started 6 months ago. And it's to help the center better achieve the results it was meant to accomplish. One of the most important projects they're working on is the push to rapidly standardize and improve healthcare billing and coding. The result of this will be to make healthcare transactions in both the public and private sector more efficient, less costly, and saving millions of dollars for all healthcare purchasers. And you may know the center recently staffed a joint public-private examination of a healthcare administrative simplification program out in Utah. Included in that event were private sector healthcare experts, practitioners, as well as staff from the governor's office, DOER, and legislators on the healthcare committees from both sides of the aisle. And it's a very important project that's expected to result in significant savings in both the public and the private sector. So with this increased appropriation, the center will be able to expand its work with DOER and DHS, as well as initiatives such as the Smart Buy Alliance, Q Care, and Healthy Connections to increase transparency of health care costs and quality, improve health outcomes, and obtain greater value for the money. The expectation is that the funding and the staff will be moved to the Department of Health. Now, the second overall program is the Employee Insurance Division. It provides our employees insurance benefits for all three branches of state government and certain quasi-state agencies. And they also administer a benefit program for local units of government known as PEEP, or the Public Employee Insurance Program. It's a fairly large group at 82.5 FTEs. This program has four activities that all deal with employee benefits. The Open General Fund appropriation is used to pay a legislative required premium to the Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association. That was formed by the state legislature in 1979. A Minnesota law requires all insurers and self-insured programs, such as the state of Minnesota, to purchase this reinsurance by becoming a member of the group. Now, there are three types of statutory appropriations, and all are dollars paid to the program by member agencies and employees. The Miscellaneous Special Revenue Fund contains operating costs for CGIP, which is the health care, PEEP, and workers' comp, plus it has about $40 million in workers' comp claim dollars. State employee insurance is dollars associated with costs for CGIP and PEEP. And the Miscellaneous Agency Fund is employee dollars paid in for the pre-tax accounts, including medical and dental, child care, and transportation. The first of these four activities is Employee Insurance Administration. You might better recognize this by its commonly known name, or CGIP, the State Employee Group Insurance Program. Now, CGIP covers 115,000 lives, including state employees and retirees and their eligible dependents. It provides benefits for all three branches of state government, as well as the quasi-state agency. And this includes MNSCU, the legislature, and the historical society. Our CGIP benefits are health, dental, life, short and long-term disability, and long-term care. We also manage the pre-tax accounts discussed in the previous section. Now, we're proposing to send this activity to finance for a variety of reasons. First of all, CGIP employee data is held in finance's computer system. The system is called Semaphore, and it's the state's payroll, HR, and benefits information system. Because the data in Semaphore is populated and used by both agencies, DOER and finance staff currently jointly operate and maintain the system. Staff from both agencies already work together to ensure that our state employees are accredited the correct set of benefits and corresponding payroll deductions. In addition, CGIP works closely with labor relations. CGIP staff is an integral part of bargaining through its efforts to identify insurance features and costs. Labor relations is slated for finance, and we believe it's important to keep these two functions together. Now, this next slide shows the administrative costs for CGIP. Miscellaneous special revenue dollars are the admin costs for the pre-tax programs and the long-term care benefit. The administration of the pre-tax accounts is funded by a fee based on the FICA savings agencies realize through employee participation in the program. That fee is $6.60 per member per month and was last changed in January of 99 when it was lowered by $3.37 per member per month. Now, our state's long-term care program is fully funded. About $100,000 in premiums are transferred annually to DOER by the vendor to support our admin costs. The state employee insurance dollars are the admin costs for the remaining benefits, health, dental, life, short, and long-term disability. These are dollars paid in, again, by employers. They pay $8.02 per member per month for all the benefits, excluding long-term care in the pre-tax accounts. And this fee has not increased since 1999. Now, CGIP's total administrative costs, including those paid to the plans for their administration, is 7.5% of the total premium costs. This compares to the industry average of between 10 and 15%. So we're really proud of how we've held the admin costs down and how we manage the employee benefits. Now, PEEP, which is the second of the four activities, provides optional health, dental, and life benefits for local units of government. It's a self-insured program that tailors benefits to the needs of each group. And this year, we've begun to offer PEEP Advantage, which is a product modeled on our own CGIPS Advantage program. This activity is funded by fees paid by the members and operates with only 2.5 staff. Although on the slide the fund is named State Employees Insurance, it's actually local employees insurance dollars here. And much of the administration of the program is done by a vendor. Total admin costs are just over $515,000 for both PEEP staff and the vendor, and the remaining dollars are claims and premiums paid. This program is closely tied to CGIP. They piggyback back on our CGIP expertise and programs, so we believe it's most efficient to keep PEEP with CGIP. Workers' Comp is a third program. It's a fully self-insured, self-administered program serving 57,000 employees in all three branches of state government, including MNSCU. The program works to ensure that when an employee is injured, the associated claims are accurately paid, and it seeks to get the injured workers back to work. Overall, 80% of injured state employees return to work, which, if you look at compared to the average of people who work for employers other than the state of Minnesota, which is 69%. We do a great job here to get our employees back to work. The activity includes the state's safety and industrial hygiene unit, and it works with state agencies to reduce the risk of work-related injuries. And we believe it's best fit with the Department of Administration. Admin currently has a risk management program, which operates as the state's internal property insurance company, and admin is responsible for many state buildings. This fits well with the safety and hygiene activity, which seeks to ensure our employees' safety. In addition, the risk management unit has extensive insurance knowledge, including extensive claims management experience, which lends itself to operating an additional insurance program. So this merger will create a total enterprise-wide view on loss control, safety, property, and workers' comp and reinsurance. Now, in addition to these management reasons for merging workers' comp with risk management, there's another reason for this choice. It was the choice of MAEP and the workers' comp employees. The workers' comp program is 34.2 FTEs and a biennial operating budget of $6.37 million. In addition, over $20 million is paid out annually in workers' comp claims, as you'll see in the next activity. These dollars included here are from fees paid by member agencies and cover the administration of the program. Now, finally, we've reached the last activity. This is the flow-through account for the insurance division's non-operating funds. These dollars cover the costs of the ongoing benefits and the dollar carryovers from year to year, and it's certainly the largest portion of our budget and is totally comprised of dedicated dollars. The $1.3 million in general fund dollars here are the open appropriation for WICRA, the workers' comp premium, which we've discussed. The remaining dollars are all non-operating funds, which are pass-through dollars for CGIP and workers' comp. They're generated by premiums paid by agencies and employees and employee pre-tax dollars. These dedicated accounts are able to invest or to retain investment income earned through the State Board of Investment, and those dollars are also expended for the purpose of the program. Miscellaneous special revenue is all workers' comp dollars used to pay claims and manage care costs, and the state employee insurance dollars are the claims and administrative costs paid to the plans for CGIP-provided benefits. The miscellaneous agency funds are the pre-tax dollars paid by state employees. These dollars are collected from employee paychecks held in this account and then transferred to the benefit manager who verifies and pays employee claims. And again, those optional pre-tax accounts are medical, dental, dependent child care, parking, and bus cards. I believe that DOOR provides valuable services that ensure state government is staffed by competent and qualified employees and provide a set of employee benefits that are innovatively designed and well-managed and cost-effective. The purpose of the merger is not to reduce the number of state employees. Rather, the purpose is to better align and strengthen DOOR's functions to enable the administration to effectively respond to the changing environments that the state faces. I believe that this proposed budget, as well as the merger, is the right thing to do to ensure that DOOR can effectively and efficiently meet the needs of the agencies and to ensure that the state's workforce is well-positioned to meet the future needs of state government. The realignment of DUER's functions into the Departments of Administration, Health, and Finance will create efficiencies and synergies in the area of human capital management, which will strengthen the state's ability to respond to the constantly changing environment of state government. I thank you for your time, and it looks like we got 20 minutes for questions.
And we've got a few other things to wrap up before we leave here. Members, you do have a fiscal note, and again, we'll get into some of this next week when we talk about Senator Rest's bill, but it doesn't appear that it doesn't look like there's going to be any loss of employees, or will there be as part of this merger?
Thank you, Senator. The part of the bill, when it comes before you, there's a provision there that protects. There'll be a provision too, but it's essentially a job protection provision for classified employees, which is everybody but nine of us, me being one. And it says that there won't be any job losses. It's a two-year provision, just like what was put on the deed merger. I support that. So essentially, there won't be any job loss outside of the classified, some of us. Certainly, my job will be lost and others within the commissioner's office. We have yet to be able to run numbers because we're not sure exactly when everything will be moved. The bill gives us from the time it passes, essentially, through June 1 of 08. So there'll be issues, but we expect that this will be a savings over time, but exactly how much is hard to determine right now.
Okay. Are there any questions, Commissioner? Again, keep in mind, we'll be looking at the merger bill next week. Senator Rest.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I look forward to presenting it. I did notice that they say, even though you mentioned, Commissioner, Mr. Chairman, that there would be nine positions lost that are unclassified or just, but on the, or correct my understanding. But then it shows on the fiscal note that there's only one FTE lost. Is that just you, or
thank
what
you.
Is that?
Thank you. Madam Senator, there are only nine people that work at DUER that are not classified. And so the bill protects everyone that's classified. So there are only nine possible unclassified positions. That's the point. The fiscal note is me only at this point because we absolutely know that I will not be there.
Okay.
So that's the way the fiscal note is written.
Thanks
so,
very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions to the Commissioner at this point? Sarah Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Anderson, when you were talking about workers' compensation activity, I was curious as to what our state's experience rating is, and how do we educate workers so that they have fewer injuries, and will that continue in another area?
Does anyone?
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Liz Holding, and I'm the Workers' Compensation Division Director. We do not, because we are a self-insured, self-administered program, we do not have an experience rating. We used to have one when the WCRA gave us an experience rating compared to other employers in the state. However, we do not have that anymore. So I'm unable to answer that question. In terms of the other question regarding what we do to prevent injuries, the commissioner mentioned in her presentation that we have a safety and industrial hygiene unit that provides these services on a statewide basis. However, there are many agencies who have safety professionals within the agency who work to provide these services as well. We just hired a safety expert to help out with those services, so we expect to see a little bit more of an effort in that area as time goes on.
So do they have classes, or do they put out employee information? I guess I haven't seen a lot of it, so I was just wondering.
Ms. Holding? Or someone else?
Can you answer?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, we do provide training classes. We provide materials that are available for state employees, such as videos, and we provide, in addition to providing the training classes ourselves, we provide services for other employees to go to training sessions that we pay for the services.
Ma'am? Mr. Chair?
Yes, Commissioner, yes.
Thank you. And I'll ask the question to you. I know our rates are lower than the outside, and I think that's what they're getting at. We may not have an experience rating because we're self-insured, but our rates are significantly lower, at least what I read in the last report that came out a few weeks ago.
Yes.
Maybe you can speak to that.
Answering your question, we don't have an experience rating. However, we, the Workers' Compensation Program does an annual report regarding the services that we provide, and we compare very well when compared to the rest of the state and their workers' compensation costs. To give you a for example, the state in 2005 paid 95 cents for every $100 in payroll, compared to other self-insured employers, and their rate was $1.20, and other employers was $1.70. Mm-hmm. So we compare very favorably, even though we don't have an official experience rating.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Well, thank you, Commissioner. We'll look forward to seeing you.
I was intrigued by the Minute Clinic at Centennial Building because I haven't heard about it. How has it been promoted? How is it being used? And are people at the Capitol Complex informed and invited to participate there as well?
I've seen signs over there, yeah.
Who can answer that? My staff.
Sure.
Nathan? Mr. Chair, this is Nathan Morocco. He's the head of the CGIP and PEEP division. So this is the insurance guy here.
Please identify yourself.
Yes. Hello. My name is Nathan Morocco, and I do manage the State Employee Group Insurance Program. Mr. Chair, Senator, the Minute Clinic was brought in a little over a year ago. We actually created a facility in the basement of the Centennial Complex. And in terms of utilization, what we do, we do have a guaranteed level of employees that we have guaranteed to Minute Clinic, which is about 50 members per month. We're not at that point right now. However, what I can say is that, as the commissioner stated, there is a savings every time that that employees do attend a Minute Clinic. And so, although we do provide a guaranteed services to Minute Clinic in terms of employees attending, because of the savings that we receive, either directly the $50 per visit, as well as the indirect costs, which amount to about 2 hours per visit per employee, the clinic itself actually does break about even.
And promoting? About promotion?
In terms of promoting, as the commissioner mentioned, it is actually built into our plan design. So every time an employee looks at our materials, there's actually a separate designation in terms of there's a Minute Clinic sort of convenience care line on our main medical webpage. So that employees realize that if they want to go into a traditional clinic, they may pay a $20 copay. They will also see a convenience care line, which says that there will be a $10 copay. So there is that constant reminder in all of our materials, whether you're going to State Employee Express, which is an online system that will provide the information about our plan design, whether you're going to our website, if you're looking at our summary plan description, pretty much everywhere that describes the basic medical services that the State Employee Group Insurance Program provides, you will see that separate designation for Minute Clinic or the convenience care systems in general.
And is it mainly if you're sick or if you just got questions or something? What do you normally go there for?
Yeah, it really is for kind of the mainstream. Many folks may have gone, Mr. Chair, many folks may have gone to that to get your flu shot. They actually list, if you go to the Centennial Building, you'll notice on the outside of the clinic, they list the services that they provide. And if it's something that's not appropriate for the clinic, if it's not a strep test, throat, or some other kind of mainstream kind of quick care need, then they will certainly direct you to your primary provider.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like we could promote that clinic heavier over in this end of the complex. So.
I think when it opened, there was an email sent out. I don't recall, but then at this time of the year, we get so many emails. You know, it's kind of hard to sort through everything we get. But I think our human resources people could probably remind us, especially as the blood pressure started going up and people are eating more junk food and like that. I think maybe they need to be reminded that it's right here. Okay. Any other questions for the commissioner? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you.
Members, I passed out the agenda for next Wednesday. Now, let me just kind of remind you where we're at. The budget forecast, the February forecast came out today. It shows a little bit of a decline. I imagine if the governor does have a supplemental budget, it probably is not going to affect us very much. We'll find out. But I can't imagine he's going to spend a lot more of it.
Yeah.
Oh, no, we're done. Yeah. Sometime within the next few days, we're going to get some targets assigned to us. We still have to look at the governor's office, the legislature, the state secretary of state, and the state auditor. That'll be done on Monday. You have the list of bills on Wednesday, and I imagine we'll have another meeting on Friday, March 9th. Now, as we start hearing these bills, I'd like to take votes to see if the members, obviously you want to hear everything to kind of get the idea, but if you hear an idea you really like and say we got to put this in the bill, you know, we may vote on it. Now that may take something else out. If you want to just put it into the mix, we'll vote on doing that. If you just say no, this is just not the direction we want to go in, we can do that too. But I'd like to get some sense as we're hearing the bills, you know, where you think this fits, because then the following week we're going to have to actually put together the bills and the budget and figure out. Now, I have been asking that, you know, if somebody wants to add a new program, they should get a bill introduced. And I've instructed my staff, I'm not going to be very receptive if somebody comes running in my office late next week and say, can I get a new program going up, get an amendment going, because, you know, you've known what the governor proposed. We've had all these hearings. Why no bills? Now, if we want to delete something or reduce funding, you don't need a bill to do that, because, that's just part of our process. Some things just are not going to get funded, and we're just going to have to make those decisions here. I think if you want to just take a program that's already in place and put a little bit more money in, a bill would be helpful. I don't know that that's so necessary. Those are just some of the discussions we're going to have as we start moving numbers around. But clearly the thing I'm trying to let people know is if they want something new, they better get a bill in soon, because we're going to start hearing these things next week. So. Any questions? Senator Rust.
The majority leader had said that on occasion that the policy part of bills would go forward separately. Is that your intent too? Or, for example, like this bill that has the savings that this committee would keep. Mm-hmm. But will the bill go forward for the policy part on its own?
As I understand the guidance from the front office, they want as few policy items in the bills, in the budget bills, as possible. They would like to have the budget, the policy and budget separated, so that as we get the budget bills, we're voting on funding things. Now, to some extent, like the Dewar merger, I think you're going to get some areas where policy and budget are going to overlap. And we do have to coordinate with the House, because it's going to be kind of awkward if we send some bills out of here in policy and then the House loads up the policy things in their budget bills, and how do you conference committee them? I mean, there's a way to do it. I mean, we can pass the bill off the floor and just deal with the conference. But the guidance, as I understand it, is to keep straight policy issues out of the budget bills.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I will certainly on the one, well, of course, the capital one. I'm just looking at the thing that needs to go to the bonding committee anyway,
right,
as I understand it.
Yeah, but some of the things are going to have to move out of finance, correct.
And I will, just to make sure that we do that, I will take on talking to my House counterpart on Senate File 887 to see whether they're going to keep it in the appropriations bill over there or move the policy separate so that won't cause us a headache over here. It's okay with me either way, but I agree with you. We need to do it the same way for both.
Well, and
if we can.
Yeah, and keep in mind, when I suggest we vote on things, that's just to get a sense of where the budget division is on these bills as we hear them. The budget committee division doesn't hold any bills. They're all in the finance committee.
Right.
So we're just taking a sense where we're at. If we decide something ought to be moved on, we can prepare a budget division report, send it up to the finance committee so that they know what we did, and then they can send it out of there. But we can't kill any bills in here because we don't have any bills. You know, we'll hear them, but we don't vote them up or down because the finance committee can do that. Anything else on what we're doing? Well, have a good weekend. Next week, things are going to really kick into high gear around here. So, if nothing further, meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much.